From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling promises strong action against supervised drug injection sites.
The opioid epidemic is arguably the number one priority of the Justice Department. And turning a blind eye to injection sites doesn't seem to me to fit with that.
Also today, the CEO of Partners Healthcare announces he's stepping down in 3 months. And a new report finds many of Boston's high school valedictorians are falling through the cracks.
It's a preventable tragedy. But we think that there's more, you know, just simple common sense fixes that could be done that could be transformative.
Plus, a young Syrian woman fights her visa denial to try to get medical treatment in Boston.
She's in danger of further trauma, and we're just trying to open a door for her to walk through to health and healing.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the increased debate about the possibility of supervised drug injection sites in Massachusetts has caught the attention of federal law enforcement. Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling is warning that he will crack down on anyone who opens a site where people could use drugs under medical supervision. And he says his response will be different from the way his office deals with prosecuting marijuana, which is also illegal under federal law. We called U.S. Attorney Lelling earlier today, and we started by asking him why he's opposed to supervised drug injection sites.
If the public decides that it really wants these sites, its fight is not with me. Its fight is with Congress. And Congress has recently demonstrated the ability to reach bipartisan consensus on law enforcement reform. And so that's where proponents should go. On my end, I have a federal statute that on its face would make this illegal, and I'll enforce it. The second prong is that I think that the studies on this are pretty mixed. I am not an expert in public health. And when I look at them, it's not clear that studies find, or reliable studies find, a consistently positive effect.
And there are folks, of course, who say that the studies show to them that death rates are reduced. And instead of debating the studies necessarily, because they have been interpreted differently, I just wonder, overall, though, as in terms of using this as a public health approach, what's your objection?
My real objection is that it is illegal. Rule of law issues matter. And what I have noticed lately, and I think this is the result of increasing political polarization, is people appear more and more tempted to simply ignore federal laws that they don't like. So marijuana, immigration, now supervised injection sites. And it doesn't work that way. So my role, my constitutional role, is to enforce federal law. I do have a philosophical objection, which is that I view it as defeat. I view it as declaring defeat. I think it normalizes drug use, intravenous drug use. And I don't think we should be or need to be doing that. And so I would not take that step.
So let's go back to the U.S. attorney position. When you say, let's try that one first. So when you say you would enforce the law because these are illegal, I wonder, would you be enforcing the law differently than on cannabis businesses, which are legal under state law, but also illegal under federal law? Now, you've said about those businesses, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they're not your focus necessarily, even though they remain illegal under federal law. But would there be a difference in terms of your enforcement efforts if it came to a supervised injection site?
You have not seen this office go after a marijuana dispensary yet. As I said during the public debate on marijuana legalization and licensing dispensaries, that I thought it was a mistake to legalize marijuana, but my resources were pointed elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And my resources were pointed to the opioid epidemic. The position I'm taking now is consistent with that. I'm not going to countenance facilitating distribution and use of opioids to addicts. I can't do that. The opioid epidemic is arguably the number one priority of the Justice Department. And sort of turning a blind eye to injection sites doesn't seem to me to fit with that. it seems to me to be a bad idea.
But I just wonder if philosophically, because of the way you feel, and because you are fighting the opioid epidemic, that there will be a concerted enforcement effort if somebody does try to open a supervised injection site.
There will be. Barring contrary direction from Washington, either from my bosses at the Justice Department or obviously if there was some kind of legislative change, then there would be enforcement by this office. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote the op-ed. I want everyone to be very clear about this, not just for rhetorical reasons, but because we have the recent debates about marijuana. And so it could be that reasonable people are wondering, sure, it's illegal in the federal code book, but would the feds really act on this? And so I want the public and the policymakers in this area to be aware that the answer is yes. The feds would have to act on this.
So that is different than cannabis.
Yes, it's different than cannabis. And again, I said that when we were talking about cannabis. It's very different.
So I wonder also, is it because in part that we heard that Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and Cambridge Mayor McGovern went up to Canada to look at sites there? Mayor Walsh initially said he was opposed. Then he said he was leaning toward such sites.
We have to talk about what is a safe injection site, what's a safe consumption site, what's the rationale behind it, we need to have that dialogue.
Is that why you're coming forward now, U.S. Attorney Lelling?
Yes. Since we're at the earlier stage of debate about injection sites, I think it's important that the public be aware that there are potential downsides to consider. And again, as I said before, that everyone's aware that, at least in this office's view, not only would it be illegal to open one, but we would pursue enforcement if they did open one.
Are there specific actions that you're thinking about legally, civil forfeiture rules for property, prosecuting medical professionals, any and all of the above?
Well, it'll depend on exactly how it plays out. All I can say is that the Controlled Substances Act, for example, allows for civil enforcement. It allows for criminal enforcement. So on the civil side, that would mean perhaps seeking an injunction to block the opening of such a site or civil forfeiture of the premises or equipment. On the criminal side, prosecution of those involved in running a site, if it was up and running. And again, there's forfeiture on the criminal side. So I don't know exactly how this would proceed, but I think those are the tools that are on the table.
You know, we recently heard about a group that has 18 chapters in 8 states, including a chapter that just formed in Massachusetts, and they are very active in Maine. We followed some of them in Maine. They call themselves the Church of Safe Injection. They hand out drug-using supplies to people, clean supplies to people, which is illegal in Maine because it's illegal for people to possess more than 10 hypodermic needles unless they're a certified needle exchange. If such a group were around Massachusetts and handing out clean-using supplies, would that fall under the purview of your office?
I think it would depend. I'd have to think about that. It would depend on what they were handing out and how they were doing it. So there are needle exchanges, for example, and we don't mess around with that, and it seems like good policy to have needle exchanges. So it depends exactly on what they were doing. I can tell you overall, this office does not prosecute street-level drug addicts. We don't do that. I mean, we agree with everyone else, not everyone else, but I think most policymakers in this area that addicts deserve treatment, deserve help. We're on board with sort of the prevention and treatment approach to the street-level addicts. We spend our time trying to run down the bulk traffickers who are selling it.
And is that what you see as a better solution here?
I think we're seeing the better way evolve. I think that what you've seen over the last few years is the Justice Department realize that it needs to help out with a more holistic approach to this epidemic, meaning you know, people say you can't arrest your way out of the opioid epidemic. I think that's true. Obviously, enforcement helps, and that's our primary task.
Okay. Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And now back to that group we mentioned during our conversation with U.S. Attorney Lelling. The Church of Safe Injection is handing out clean drug-using supplies in cities around the country, even in places where that's illegal. They say they have a spiritual mission to try to save lives because the public health system has failed. Recently, we went along with some group volunteers in Maine, where the Church of Safe Injection launched a few months ago.
Thank you.
On a bitter, cold, recent afternoon at a park in front of the central bus stop in Bangor, about a half dozen people surround a folding table covered with handmade signs. The signs are offering free, clean syringes and naloxone, also known as Narcan, the drug that reverses an opioid overdose.
We have naloxone, the overdose drug. We have clean syringes. We have some safe use supplies, which would be cookers, straps, cottons.
This man goes by Dave Caravaggio, even though that's not his real name. He doesn't want to be identified because it's illegal in Maine to have more than 10 hypodermic syringes unless you're a certified needle exchange. Police cars sometimes circle the park when they're there, but no one's been arrested yet. Oh, there's a police car right there. Police ever stop and talk to you or anything?
There's one officer who's come and talked to us a couple times.
But this time, the police car keeps driving. Caravaggio is a member of the group called the Church of Safe Injection. He says its mission is to help prevent diseases and overdose deaths.
I believe that there's not just a moral duty to violate unjust laws, but in this circumstance, a spiritual duty.
Bangor Police Sergeant Wade Betters knows about the group and says he wants to meet with them. He believes their focus should be on getting people into treatment.
You know, if you're committing a crime in the state of Maine, yeah, you could be subject to arrest or ticketed for that offense. But in these particular cases, we generally use a lot of discretion because, again, the goal is the same, to save lives.
At the next stop, in Lewiston, police have warned volunteers there not to hand out syringes in a local park, reminding them that it is illegal. But that hasn't really stopped them.
There's one, two, there's three failings.
Candace Child is in a car packed full of boxes of syringes and other drug-using equipment. Because of the police warning and because it's so cold, Child arranged meeting spots to give people their supplies. We stop at a street corner where two young men wait as she rummages through the boxes.
I'm going to give you 100. Okay. What about alcohol wipes? You need any of those?
Yeah, actually.
Child says she does this because she has a family member who's struggling. She also says there are only 6 certified needle exchange programs in Maine, none in Lewiston.
Thank you.
You're welcome. God bless you.
Child says she's willing to risk arrest because she believes she's doing what government health officials should be.
And why wait? Should we all sit around and talk and point fingers, or should we all get off our ass and go do something about it? This helps, it works, it saves lives, it reduces HIV, it reduces hepatitis.
We head to a third floor apartment where 3 people are waiting to trade containers filled with used syringes for clean ones.
Hey, so we got 60. Do you want some fentanyl test strips?
A 36-year-old man who didn't want his name public because he's using drugs is uneasy. He says he's glad to get the clean equipment, but he admits that he's conflicted about whether getting these supplies makes it easier for him to use drugs.
The only reason I struggle is the inner conflict, you know? It's like there's a preventative maintenance, yet at the same time it's enabling, you know?
Even the founder of the Church of Safe Injection, 26-year-old Jesse Harvey, admits that he's struggled with that same question. But working in addiction recovery, Harvey says he's become frustrated by the deaths and the barriers to treatment. So Harvey plans to register the church as a nonprofit and then argue for a religious exemption from drug laws. He says the U.S. Supreme Court has already ruled that a religious group is allowed to use an illegal psychedelic in its rituals. But Harvey's quick to say that he's not advocating legalizing drugs.
We're not saying that it's our sincerely held religious belief that we have a right to use this heroin. No, not at all. We're saying that it's our sincerely held religious belief that people who use drugs don't deserve to die when there are decades of solutions. And the state's not going to do it? Well, guess what? We're going to do it.
Harvey says his church has 18 branches in 8 states, including one in Massachusetts. He says he'll eventually have a location that will include a site where people could inject drugs under supervision. For now, though, his congregants will continue risking arrest to hand out supplies. There's some surprising news out of Partners Healthcare. CEO David Torchiana announced that he'll step down at the end of April. Torchiana became CEO in March of 2015. Partners is the largest healthcare system in Massachusetts and the state's largest private employer. WBUR's Martha Biebinger is here to talk about what this means. Hi there, Martha.
Hi, Deborah.
So why is this important?
Well, Deb, you've probably heard Partners referred to as the 800-pound gorilla of healthcare in Massachusetts, right? So when the 800-pound gorilla makes a dramatic move, there are ripple effects across the state. Partners has 12 hospitals, 27% of hospital stays. It was begun in 1994 with two prominent hospitals, Mass General and the Brigham. Now, those places are really critical in terms of teaching the next generation of doctors, nurses, and many medical professionals. Their mission includes research that breaks ground all the time in healthcare. There's really a lot of force, a lot of life energy that comes out of Partners in Massachusetts.
And then what about Dr. Torchiana? Who is he and how did he become CEO 4 years ago?
Well, he's a very big guy in personality and in stature. He's 6'6", and he's a forceful presence when he's in the room. He doesn't mince words when he talks. He's a grad of Harvard Medical School. He built his reputation, Deb, at Mass General. He was a cardiac surgeon who became very distinguished and took over the 2,000-person physicians group there at Mass General. That kind of cemented his management interests and credentials. He stepped into the role as CEO at Partners in March 2015.
Hmm. So what do we know about why he's leaving? I heard there were reports of friction between him and MGH and the Brigham. Anything to do with that?
Yes. So I started hearing about this in the fall around the proposed merger or possible merger of Partners Healthcare and Harvard Pilgrim, the health insurer. So, you know, hospitals around the country are starting to bring in health insurers so they can manage more of the costs and the patient care and such. But Partners had a difficult experience when it brought in the first health insurer, which was Neighborhood Health Plan. Back in 2016, there was a $104 million loss tied to Neighborhood Health Plan. So a lot of people on the Partners board and some hospital executives said, hold on, you want to bring in another health insurer? Are you sure?
Right.
So that was sort of put on hold. At the same time, Dr. Torchiana had been a big advocate of expanding beyond the Massachusetts border and this time south into Rhode Island with the acquisition of a network that includes Rhode Island Hospital in Providence. But there were real questions about what kind of voting rights would that new entity have with regards to these already big players, Mass General and the Brigham, and that deal fell apart. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of tension about, like, you know, what are you trying to do exactly here, Torch? Everyone just calls him Torch. That's his nickname.
So what were his main accomplishments then during his almost 4 years on the job or his leadership style?
Well, he's very admired and respected, you know, on a day-to-day basis. He did complete the acquisition of Mass Eye and Ear, which is downtown right next to Mass General. He had started when some of these during some of this period of tension, there was a Partners 2.0 initiative that involved bringing a lot of people into the group to talk about the future of Partners Healthcare. And it looks like those groups will continue.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think his departure affects sort of the long-term vision for Partners?
Well, this was about vision. This was a question of whether the hospitals individually drive the direction of Partners or whether Partners as a whole really transforms itself by bringing in many more health insurers, many more hospitals outside the state. And I think that's really in question now that those two initiatives that Torch was so closely tied to do not seem to be going forward.
And how might patients be affected here, Martha?
People that I talked to today really stressed that there will be no impact on patient care, that the thousands of doctors and nurses and physician assistants who are taking care of people today will continue to do so with the same commitment, that this is really about a bigger picture question about the future, as we just discussed.
What about a potential successor?
So traditionally, because these two hospitals, because Partners was started with Mass General and Brigham and Women's, the leadership of Partners has gone back and forth between those two institutions. So Torch came from Mass General. The idea would be that Dr. Betsy Nabel, who's the current president of the Brigham, would step in. She declined comment today. There is some talk about whether there might be a co-CEO, maybe both Dr. Peter Slavin at Mass General and and Dr. Betsy Nabel at the Brigham might do this together. But it's not really clear whether partners will do something altogether different. Right now, all we know is they're going to appoint an interim leader.
All right. WBUR's Martha Biebinger, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, what should be done to help top-performing high school students stay on the path to success? I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. For most students, graduating at the top of the class puts them on a path to success. But for many Boston Public High School valedictorians, that does not appear to always be the case. The Boston Globe surveyed many Boston valedictorians who graduated between 2005 and 2007 and found that a quarter of them failed to graduate college within 6 years. They also found that 40% earned less than $50,000 a year. Four Boston valedictorians have been homeless. Two of the reporters who worked on this story are with us in studio. Megan Irons, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deb.
Also, Malcolm Gay, welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
Also with us is one of the high school valedictorians, Shanika Bridges King. She graduated at the top of her Boston English class in 2006 and is now an elementary school teacher. Shanika, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So I want to start with you, Shanika, because you were the valedictorian at Boston English. As we said, you won a full scholarship. But what happened when you got to college?
When I went to college, I began to struggle academically. This is the first time I've been exposed to, I think, a private, intellectual, critical thinking environment. And so I found myself oftentimes studying late, but getting extra support from my professors and or other students on the college campus. I didn't feel like I was prepared to navigate the academic discourse. So I had to work extremely hard to ensure that I actually met my expectations in achieving great success at Bryn Mawr College.
So you were surprised? Were you surprised? I mean, what were you thinking when it was happening?
I think I was surprised because I'm like, oh, here I am. I'm top of my class. I have a 4.63 GPA, leaving BPS. I'm like, I'm about to conquer the world. However, amongst arriving there, I was like, oh, my gosh. There was a culture shock, but then it was also this ideal of like, wow, I can't even understand or comprehend what I am reading at this moment. That was a lot of stress, especially because I was navigating this new environment,
right.
Which was a cultural difference. And then on top of that, this fierce understanding of how to actually think critically and read to comprehend is something that I didn't have at the time.
And what about the other students you were with? I mean, were they helpful or how did that work?
The other students
that you were with in college?
Yes, they were. So a lot of them came from elite backgrounds. They was wealthy and they came from elite private schools. And there was a lot of programs within Bryn Mawr College to support students who was not doing well. So these students, they kind of opened up and they begin to like take different campus jobs. So there's a writing center where I went to the writing center very often to edit my work and to learn how to write a complex sentence. And then there was also the times that I sat in professor's office challenging them, but more importantly, trying to understand, think critically about the text that I actually read.
Yeah. Wow. So that's how you adapted. You really had to seek this out on your own. It wasn't like you had a ton of help.
No, there wasn't. Except for I did have the Posse scholarship. So I did go in with 9 other students. And so I did have a mentor there. So she made sure that I was exposed to the right resources and to the right people, too, to help.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about all of this when you hear about the Globe story and looking at all the valedictorians and what happened? What are your thoughts?
Very interesting question, because we were just discussing this. And so I think reading these stories kind of open up a lot of pain because it was the ideal of reliving some of our experiences while you know, growing up in poverty, but then more importantly, while thinking we're getting a great, strong education, but not really understanding how systemic oppression work and how certain students within the urban systems were not allowed to access the same resources as other students that didn't look like us. And thus, it's kind of like a painful but rewarding experience because now this article is out, and I think a lot of the politics that play a role in ensuring that urban students are not given the same resources to adequately compete in this world is being exposed. And so it kind of opened a lot of doors. And hopefully new reform will come out of this as well.
Yeah. So Malcolm Gay, in your reporting for this Boston Globe series on high school valedictorians, how common? Tell us the numbers. How common are stories like Shanika's, where high-performing students in BPS really struggled after they left?
Well, so that's one of the things that we set out at first to reach 113 valedictorians. We ended up reaching on 93 of them. And so certain patterns started to emerge, and one of the clear patterns that emerged is that these students who graduated at the top of their class would arrive at oftentimes elite colleges with GPA-dependent scholarships and would immediately start to struggle, particularly in science and math classes. And during that time, their struggles would be accompanied by oftentimes emotional feelings of isolation, alienation on these campuses. They felt kind of that they were alone on campus, while also having their grades, you know, start to tank. And so their GPA, their scholarship is now in jeopardy, which adds to their stress levels. And so oftentimes, Shanika graduated within 4 years, but a lot of the students that we spoke with took 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, had to leave the original school that they went to, and ended up graduating from lesser schools while doing that. And so what we were able to see by interviewing 93 valedictorians is these kind of broader trends within the valedictorian cohort. And Shanika's experiences of getting to school, feeling inadequately prepared by Boston Public Schools is pretty typical.
So, Shanika, when you did mention culture shock, I mean, talk a little bit about that when you were at school. How did that factor into your whole experience and some of what you were feeling when you were there? And while I understand the academics, but what about socially and culturally?
I think so. Of course, in BPS, everybody in the particular school that I was attending looked just like me. So either they had similar hair, similar skin context, like everything was similar. We all kind of was raised in this poverty environment, and so we kind of had similar socioeconomic backgrounds as well. But as soon as I entered Bryn Mawr College, it was a new world. It was like, wow. Everybody was white, but it was a predominantly white environment. And not only did I see, there were a few people who looked like me. However, they did not have similar socioeconomic backgrounds, so they didn't understand who I was. And so we couldn't relate on that level as well. And I think I relied on the coursework that I engaged with, which was sociology and education, to then start to understand my social being and where I stood in that Bryn Mawr world. And so while doing that, oftentimes I'll be in class and I'll challenge the notion of, well, this book states that people like me shouldn't be able to achieve great success, but here I am. So why beat the odds, you know? So where am I in this particular book? And right. So oftentimes I end up having a lot of extra hours with the professors discussing this, trying to go against theory that's supposed to, I guess, I think it's supposed to hold true for people that come from environments like myself. And so oftentimes I would find myself in office hours and or with my posse and or with people who just supported me. So I think race wasn't a big issue for me at Bryn Mawr. I think the larger issue was socioeconomic background.
Wow. Wow. So Megan Irons, I'm wondering, this series also, it didn't even only find that it's BPS in general. There are huge discrepancies among the schools within the Boston Public School System. So why don't you explain that a little bit?
Yes. We found that Boston Public Schools is a system of two different types of schools systems, if that makes any sense. You have the exam schools and you have the other schools. The exam schools are doing what they need to do to prepare students for college and beyond. The other schools, prognosis is varied on that. One of the reasons is because when you have very savvy parents in BPS who know how to work the system, they know when to take the tests, they know who to go to get tutoring, they invest a lot, they're very knowledgeable, and usually they are white and more knowledgeable, and they are the ones that typically get the edge in terms of preparing their students for the exams that you need to take, I think, by the sixth grade to get into the seventh grade at a Boston Latin School or any of the other exam schools, whereas a vast majority of students are sort of languishing in the other schools. They being raised by grandparents or immigrant parents who don't understand the system and don't know to take the test by the sixth grade. And they end up in a school system going to schools that are failing or floundering or struggling. And what ends up happening is that you have the exam schools educating a vast majority of really smart kids, and the traditional schools really in need of all of the kinds of rigor and care and attention that the exam schools have. As we said in the piece, Malcolm brilliantly wrote it, you know, you have the exam schools and then you have mediocrity. And I think what we were trying to show, in addition to the chasm between the exam schools and the traditional schools, is that there needs to be a much more centered focus on the schools that are preparing the vast majority of our students. Students who, like Shanika, end up at a Bryn Mawr struggling and feeling really overwhelmed by the not just the culture shock, but the rigor of academics.
So, Malcolm, I wonder, you know, some of the statistics in this series were pretty striking. Five of the eight exam school valedictorians that you spoke with went to Harvard. Just three of the 80 non-exam school valedictorians went to an Ivy League school. Just one went to Harvard. And then white and Asian students made up 75% of all students entering Boston Latin. So, you know, I know savvy parents are part of it, but does the school system have a responsibility here? And what does the school say about your series? What response did you get from BPS?
Right. So I think that to add partially to what Megan was saying and to answer your question, part of the issue in Boston is that the district itself is so heavily invested in the exam school model. You know, whereas in New York, 5% of the student body goes to, you know, these types of exam schools. In Boston, it's 25% of the student body. And while that may, on the one hand, seem like this terrific opportunity for 25% of the kids, what it really means is they're taking the cream off the top of the student body. And, you know, the rest of the schools that are not exam schools are left to deal with court adjudicated kids, kids that are high needs, special needs, you know, low income children. And, you know, study after study will show that if you have an academically mixed or a socioeconomically mixed classroom with high achieving students and low achieving students, the high achieving students will maintain that high level of rigor, and the lower achieving students will rise to meet those high-achieving kids. And what Boston, the current system in Boston Public Schools, removes that level of high-achieving kids from the rest of the schools. You know, obviously, there are questions of equity and opportunity in terms of getting into the exam schools, which is also, you know, a huge, huge issue. So I think that those are real points where BPS, you know, where the city really should be having the conversation. In terms of response to the series, it's been truly, you know, it's been terrific. It's been really tremendous, the amount of response, the amount of interest that people have had in the series. And I think that's partially because of using the lens of the valedictorians who, you know, have obviously shown that given the tools, will succeed. It really allows the series to kind of investigate structural issues. Right. The one area that we've not heard from, however, is BPS.
You haven't heard from BPS?
Not a peep.
No, I saw just one quote in one of the stories that said the district is dealing with imbalances by doing things like expanding access to both accelerated courses and a free test prep program. Mm-hmm. But the school acknowledged that it needed to do more. But I wonder if there are some folks listening thinking, you know, when there has been a lifetime of maybe neglect and other things and disparities, how much can the school do to kind of shore up the students and create a level playing field? What are your thoughts on that, Megan?
Well, one thing they can do is to make sure that all students are, you know, abiding by the MAS scores, the state standards for graduation, which is, I wrote this down so I wouldn't forget, 4 years of English and math, 3 years of science and social studies, and 2 years of world language. And as part of the series, we found that BPS has not done a good job at this. And this is sort of basic when it comes to preparing our students for graduation in the future beyond. They could also do a better job at dealing... Were you going to say?
No, no.
Okay. They could also do a better job at, you know, the big gap in science education. There's been a lot of promises made on this, and BPS has still not come through with that. Certainly, the school system has begun to address the disparities at the high school level, but clearly, from our series, from the stories that we heard from valedictorians, from the fact that today, nearly half of the students who leave BPS and go to college do not graduate. It means there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
I would like to say that I think I misspoke earlier when I said one of the non-exam school, Boston Public School valedictorians went to Harvard. It was none of the valedictorians went to Harvard, so I want to correct that. But I also want to bring another voice into the conversation here. Sam Acevedo, Executive Director of the Boston Higher Education Resource Center. This center pairs college prep coaches with students at 8 Boston non-exam public high schools. Sam, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be on it.
So what do you take from this series about Boston Public School valedictorians and where they are now?
I really appreciate what Malcolm and Megan have done, because the Globe is essentially connecting a set of faces and names to data that we've been hearing for some time now. In 2008, the Boston Private Industry Council put out a report that just shocked Boston, indicating that our best and our brightest were enrolling in college, but even after 7 years, they weren't graduating from college. And in the Annenberg Foundation, together with the Barr Foundation in 2014, put out a similar report saying that Black and Latino males weren't achieving. And just this last spring, Ernst & Young and Parthenon put out a report that is saying that about 18% of our youth in Boston Public Schools were not on track to graduate from high school, let alone go on to college. What the Globe has done is put us in connection, just connected us into
Sam,
the
Sam, we have limited amount of time, so can we talk a little bit about the issues as well? I just want to know, because
sure.
we only have about a minute or two left here. So can you tell us, you know, sort of more broadly, beyond Boston Public Schools, what can schools do to deal with these inequities?
I think that there are some practices that are common sense, research-recommended practices that we've known for some time. And one of the things that we try to do through the Boston Higher Education Resource Center is failure-proof first-generation Black and Latino youth by introducing them to a culture of academia, just giving a student like Shanika a heads up as to what it's going to be like to walk onto a college campus and how to endure the culture shock of being on a college campus. And we can't take for granted that the students at non-exam high schools know how to navigate things like, you know, project management skills, relationship management skills, how to measure their time, how to be advocates for themselves, and also in collaboration with entities such as Success Boston, which actually emerged out of 2008 from that Boston PIC report, provide post-secondary support, not unlike the POSSE program that was so instrumental in Shanika's success.
Right. Do you think, though, that schools have the bandwidth for that? I bet you they would argue that they might not.
They don't, and they don't have to. There are some excellent nonprofit organizations. Besides the Boston Higher Education Resource Center, there's some wonderful nonprofit organizations in the city of Boston that would love to supplement the bandwidth of Boston Public Schools. We're already partnering in droves with Boston Public Schools. The five entities of the Boston Wins program that State Street has put together has a mission to change these numbers. The Success Boston Collaborative, put together by the Boston Foundation in the wake of the 2008 report, is also on a similar mission. There is no district quite like the Boston Public Schools district in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Mm. Our students are very special. They're resilient. They're courageous. They've endured things that their peers in other districts just have no context for. And if they were to achieve a higher education and break into the professions, they're precisely the types of people that we need to be leaders in this nation to get us through the crises that we're facing, such as the opioid crises.
Sam, I just want to make sure that I get Shanika to weigh in here. Shanika, I just wonder, last word goes to you. You're now an elementary school teacher. What do you do to encourage students to try to sort of make sure that they don't face the same inequities?
I think first to expose them to success stories.
Like yours.
Like myself. Mm-hmm. And I try to bring in other friends who are also successful. And I think my number one goal is to inspire, but more important, to teach kids how to read adequately. So my decision to become an elementary school teacher was because there's a huge gap in between students being able to read and comprehend, to critically think. Once they get to middle school, they end up dropping out. And so if you catch them at an early age and you kind of educate them adequately, there's no reasons why they can't excel and do well. And I think I'm also looking at the lens of like a social justice lens. And so I educate them on who they are and what their role is in society. So I feel like I'm raising a bunch of educational allies as I'm educating the future.
All right. Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Shanika Bridges-King, valedictorian of Boston English's class of 2006. Her story was profiled in the Boston Globe recent story about valedictorians. Thank you, Shanika.
Thank you.
Also with us, Boston Globe reporters, Malcolm Gay. Malcolm, thanks to you.
Thanks so much.
And Megan Irons. Thank you,
Megan.
Thank you. And Sam, Sam Acevedo, the Executive Director of the Boston Higher Education Resource Center, thanks to you as well. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A nonprofit in Boston is among those working on behalf of a 16-year-old Syrian girl who is seeking medical treatment in the U.S. after she was disfigured in a bomb attack. After the attack, the young girl, whom we're referring to only by her first name, Marwa, fled to Turkey and then to Germany, where she and her family now live. The doctors there are recommending more treatment at Shriners Hospital in Boston, but the U.S. denied Marwa's visa request because she could not prove that she would return to Germany. Joining us is Carrie Shushart, president of the nonprofit House of Peace in Ipswich, Mass., which provides temporary housing for refugees and others. Carrie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deb. Nice to be with you today.
Also with us, Liz Nicholson, volunteer advocate for refugees and an English lecturer at the Friedrich University at Erlangen. Thanks for being with us, Liz.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
If you could tell us, Liz, you've been advocating for Marwa for, I understand, about 2 years now. Can you just tell us a bit about her?
Yes, not exactly 2 years. I met Marwa at an event that I helped to organize here in Erlangen. It was a welcome refugees event for refugees living in Erlangen. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first saw Marwa. That was last March. And I was so struck by this young girl's bravery, because despite her severe disfigurement, she had the courage to go on stage and perform a song with her classmates in front of 200 people.
Wow.
So that's when I first saw Marwa.
Hmm. She's 16 years old. She is.
Yes.
As you say, she was severely disfigured in this bomb attack, and she wants to come to the U.S. for treatment. Couldn't she get the treatment in Germany? Why here in Boston?
Well, she has had multiple surgeries, both in Turkey and in Germany. But from my time in Boston, I became familiar with Shriners Burns Institute, and they are renowned,
right.
Really. So I got in touch with Shriners and sent off all the paperwork. And they got back to me almost immediately offering to treat Marwa free of charge. Mm-hmm. And then I spoke to Marwa's surgeon here, of course, and he said it would actually be wonderful if Marwa could have treatment at Shriners.
Mm-hmm. Now, as
because they are the experts, you know, mm-hmm. for treating severe burns victims.
Yeah. And now, as we said, the hold up on the part of the U.S. government is that there's not proof that she would necessarily return to Germany, where she's now living with her family. Would her family come along with her when she gets this treatment at Shriners?
Her father would accompany her. Marwa has six siblings, and her mother would have to stay here because her youngest sibling is only 3 years old.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there, do you think they have sufficient ties in Germany and they would return? What are your thoughts about that, Liz?
Oh, absolutely. Marwa has no ties in the U.S., and she's firmly embedded here in the local community. She goes to school here. And, of course, her parents are here, her six siblings are here, her uncle and his family live here, and her grandparents are here.
So, Carrie, I wonder if somehow Marwa's visa were to be approved, if there's a reapplication process, the House of Peace, I understand, would take her in. Tell us a little bit more about the program where you take in folks like Marwa to get treatment. Do you have families there now with you?
Yes, we do. And we've been in Ipswich as a nonprofit corporation for 29 years. And it's during about the past 15 years that we've been welcoming children from mostly Middle Eastern countries who are seriously wounded by bombs or by so-called collateral damage, all of them victims of tremendous injuries. And at the moment, we have a young woman from Iraq who just arrived and will have repeated surgery at Shriners. She was here 10 years ago as a 10-year-old child and is returning for another series of corrective surgeries at this point. And we've had children mostly from Iraq. We have had a young girl from Syria who came to us before the travel ban.
And how long do they typically stay?
It depends on the needs of the child and the protocol for surgeries at Shriners, but the typical stay is between 3 and 6 months.
Now, have you noticed, where can you describe for us how President Trump's travel ban has affected people trying to come to the House of Peace? Like, what are you seeing because of this the fight over immigration?
Exactly. Well, it was so significant that the travel ban itself went into effect just 7 days after the inauguration of Trump. And still since that time,
hello?
It really has affected us in our very small microcosm, so to speak. But, of course, countless hundreds of thousands of people that are seeking medical treatment that are on the list of countries who are banned from coming to the U.S., what we're experiencing, the present situation, is a kind of a consciousness that this travel ban, which has many ramifications and many manifestations, saying a child of 16 has no credible ties to the country where her family is, Liz has just described, Liz. To me, that's part of this ever-towering wall and the inability to recognize the human rights of a child and of a family to receive the health care that they require. So we're seeing it as having a huge impact on people. Of course, the whole mood about immigrants and refugees coming from the administration has escalated anxiety and fear across the whole spectrum of people
right.
who are attempting to make their home in this country. But for children in need such as Marwa, that are definitely seeking temporary help, it's a big, huge difference.
Okay, Carrie Shuchart, President of the House of Peace in Ipswich, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for your care, Deb.
Liz Nicholson, who helps, who advocates for refugees in Germany. Liz, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
That's our show for today. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.